Ben Goldsmith took Emmanuel Fair's case in August of 2012, he knew the odds were not in his favor. This belief was based on statistics. The vast majority of criminal charges end with a defendant pleading guilty before trial. And a recent study estimated that more than 3/4 of violent felonies that do reach a trial end with guilty verdicts. Then there were the compounding factors. Emmanuel Fair was a young Black man in a system that has been historically and overwhelmingly unkind to young Black men. Moreover, the prosecution had presented evidence that Emmanuel Fair's DNA was in the midst of the crime scene, and Ben and his team had not contested that evidence. They'd only sought to place it into the proper context. So when the jury forewoman stepped forward to tell the judge she and her 11 peers were deadlocked, Ben was relieved.
Because I felt like the jury had been out so long, the chances of them coming back not guilty was just getting increasingly small. So it was sort of a feeling of living to fight another day.
For Emmanuel, the feeling, obviously, was a little more complicated. He told me recently that he considered a mistrial at first to be a win. Then he realized how far he had to go.
Man, I've just felt like, honestly, I felt like, man, I should have been going home today. You know what I'm saying? That's how I felt. You know what I'm saying? So I was a little upset. But, you know, I mean, I just knew we had to go back to the drawing board.
Later that day, after Emmanuel was sent back to the King County Jail, Ben spent some time talking to the jurors. They told him the same thing they'd told me. Most of them had leaned towards acquittal.
It seemed like there were 6 jurors in that first case who were very strong for not guilty. But there are really only a couple of strong advocates in favor of guilt. And to me, in a case like this, where the state's evidence wasn't going to get any better, I thought that the just thing to do would be to not retry the case. But they let us know pretty quickly that they were going to retry it no matter what.
Ben played every card he had. He asked the prosecutors what they thought might change in the course of a second trial. No dice. He figured the state had sunk so many resources, so much taxpayer money into the case, that at this point it would be very difficult for them to walk away. And regardless, the prosecutors were adamant. They still believed Emmanuel was the killer. At this point, Emmanuel had been behind bars for almost 10 years. Ben begged the judge to let him out on bond. The judge declined. Emmanuel remembers her saying that it was because he had been incarcerated for so long that she couldn't let him out. It was unclear whether he was, quote, a threat to society. So he would remain in jail until the next trial started. He would try to be patient, even as he saw old friends grow up, have families of their own, and stop coming to visit as often. And Emmanuel was frustrated with Ben. Again? He had to go through another trial? But he never showed that frustration.
I don't do no yelling, man. I just put my head down and just say what I gotta say and be like, I'm done talking, man. And then when you come visit me and they say, Fair, you got an attorney visit, and I say, I ain't going. That's what I do.
He took solace where he could find it.
You know, there was an officer that told me when I was in the King County Jail, he said, go grab a piece of paper and a pencil. He was standing outside my cell, so I went to my desk, grabbed a piece of paper and a pencil, and he said, take that pencil and put a dot on the piece of paper. So I did that, and he said, that's all you need. And I said, what do you mean? He said, that's all the faith that you need. You know, and that carried me a long way.
Ben Goldsmith had decided he wasn't giving up. Whether or not Emmanuel was willing to talk to him, he filed a motion to have the case dismissed on the grounds the state had insufficient evidence, but the motion was ultimately tossed out. He also approached the members of Emmanuel's family church in the Central District.
We wanted to make sure that the community was aware of this prosecution that we felt was really unjust, and we wanted to see if we could garner some community support so they could reach out to the prosecutors, you know, tried to tell them a little bit about where the case was and tried to have a call to action to have them reach out to the prosecution on Emmanuel's behalf. And I think several of them did. it didn't seem to change the prosecution's mind.
Finally, he lobbed his Hail Mary and reached out to Ben Haggerty, otherwise known as Macklemore. Yeah, that Macklemore. Internationally famous Seattle rapper. The guy with 4 Grammys and a string of sold-out global tours. I'm gonna pop some tags, only got $20 in my pocket. Macklemore and Emmanuel had been friends in high school and kept up some since. And Emmanuel had written to Macklemore from jail, telling him about the case and professing his innocence.
And at this time, you know, my career is popping. I'm very rarely home. I have a lot of fan mail and stuff that I just don't open. And finally, I read Emmanuel's letter and then explained the case. And I was just like, this is insane.
Macklemore hadn't attended the 2017 trial, but the more he read and heard about the case, the more frustrated he got. So, not long after the mistrial was declared, the two Bens, Goldsmith and Macklemore, got acquainted.
And I just kind of asked him, you know, what's the move here?
Macklemore spends a lot of time, effort, and thought leveraging his fame to promote social justice causes. He has connections everywhere, and enough clout to get Dan Satterberg, the district attorney, Aaron Ellert's boss, to sit down for coffee.
At the time, I was very entrenched in the case. I knew the players, I knew the names, I knew the components, and I was fighting for my friend's life. So I gave him my best, most thoughtful A-plus version of a pitch of how can Emmanuel be in county right now while there's all this other evidence and lack of evidence for Emmanuel. And basically it was like, I don't believe you guys have a case. Beyond a reasonable doubt, I don't believe you have a case. And I think that this is absolutely a case that is racially fueled.
Macklemore knew he could expect at least a moderately friendly reception. Satterberg is one of the most liberal DAs in the country. He created a conviction integrity unit. He also started a program that sent low-level drug offenders to social workers instead of prison. So he is exactly who Macklemore wanted to be talking to. And Satterberg did hear him out. He listened as Macklemore argued that the evidence tying Emmanuel to the crime was thin. Whereas the evidence pointing at other suspects, well, in Macklemore's opinion, that wasn't so thin.
When you have someone that literally tried to flee the country the next day that's free. I think they messed up. I think they messed up. And, you know, the unfortunate part of all of this is Arpana's death and their family has no closure. They have no conviction and their daughter is dead. And I think that it was a really messed up case, and it was messy, and it wasn't clear, and they arrested the black man with priors.
Finally, Macklemore's allotted time with Satterberg wound down.
I don't think that he wanted to own any sort of part in that this case was racially biased, but he heard other parts. He validated that. And at the end of it said, this case has been going on for years. There's no way that we're going to drop it at this point.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From Campside Media and Wondery, I'm Matthew Scherr, and this is Suspect. This is episode 8, Redux. At Emmanuel's first trial, Ben Goldsmith had worked hand in hand with a public defender named Paul Vernon. Paul had actually delivered the opening statement that had laid the foundation for Emmanuel's innocence in some jurors' minds. But soon after the end of the trial, Paul moved cross country to New York, and Ben went searching for a new partner.
What did you have for breakfast?
I had a muffin, a vegan berry muffin, just 5 minutes ago, and then a whole lot of coffee.
Catherine Edwards was 33 when she was assigned Emmanuel's case. She and Ben are a study in contrasts. Ben's an East Coaster. He's got this directness to him, a bluntness that some read as arrogance. Catherine is a tattooed, vegan muffin-eating Seattle native. She's got a left coast, progressive idealism to her. She always has.
So when I was in the eighth grade, I wanted to be a public defender. I did like a passion project being a public defender. So in my office, actually, at work, I have my like poster board that I did when I was in the eighth grade.
By her 20s, Catherine had decided that the passion project she'd presented in eighth grade was more than just a project. It was her life calling. And after law school, she signed on with the public defender's office in King County. At first, she worked lower stakes crimes, but eventually she moved on to major felonies. And although she hadn't been part of the team that defended Emmanuel at his first trial, she had helped Ben and his previous co-litigator workshop their opening and closing arguments. And when they'd explained the case to her, she couldn't quite believe what she was hearing.
When they read the opening to me was really when I first saw the case as a whole. You know, I'd heard fragments about certain pieces of evidence and Cameron Johnson's name was flying around. And then Paul played some of the audio from Cameron's interviews. I was like, oh, okay, this is what this case is about. Why are we going to trial in this case? Like, how did this get this far? Was sort of my initial reaction.
This belief of Catherine's was very much intertwined with another belief, which became even stronger the more she immersed herself in the case. That Cameron Johnson, a young white man, had been treated radically different from Emmanuel at every step. To Catherine, that was the story of this case.
I think the easiest way for me to think about it is the benefits afforded to Cameron Johnson and the complete opposite afforded to Emmanuel. They were looking at every stage of the game for an innocent explanation for Cameron, for all of his behavior, not just the DNA. And they never afforded Emmanuel that grace. And to me, that, I think, boils down to race.
So what do you think? Do you think Emmanuel is just really... what do you make of what happened to him? Was he just horribly unlucky and that he happened to be at this party and happened to have a record?
I think so. And happened to be black. Yeah.
In the summer of 2017, Catherine began meeting with her new client, who is now entering his eighth year behind bars. She and Emmanuel hit it off. Catherine found Emmanuel to be smart, perceptive, and genuinely interested in her life.
I got married while I was working on the case. And so he was always asking about those things. And he's a big sports fan and I'm a big sports fan. So we would talk a lot about sports. And I kind of got him to interested in watching the Premier League soccer because he was always looking for things to watch. And they're on early in the morning so he could watch those. And so then we would chat about those things.
Ben may have gone through several murder trials before, but this was Catherine's first. The more she got to know Emmanuel, the more pressure she felt.
The thing that still affects me is feeling responsible for Emmanuel and feeling like I'm going to screw up for him. That was a huge source of anxiety leading up to the trial, and it's still something that I deal with. This podcast is not about me, but like this was a very trying mental experience for me. I have obsessive compulsive disorder, and I really had quite a meltdown, a couple meltdowns while prepping for this case. Just the sheer pressure of wanting to do a good job for Emmanuel and not screwing up was just like really overwhelming for me. It was a struggle.
Catherine was accustomed to dealing with two versions of her clients. The accused as they appear on paper, reduced to the sum of the entries on their rap sheets, and the accused person sitting in front of her, a person in three dimensions.
Because what we get is we get a case, we get the police's version of events, and then we usually get their criminal history. But if those were the only facts, the only world that I lived in, everyone would be guilty. It's only when you actually really meet with clients, hear their stories, talk about witnesses that they may have, talk about mental health issues, chemical dependency issues, like looking at the whole person and picture, that the true sort of quote-unquote truth sort of comes out.
With Emmanuel Fair, the dichotomy was especially noticeable. Emmanuel's criminal history was a big part of what had driven police to pursue Emmanuel as a suspect.
I've thought about this a lot. The only thing I can say is that I deal with human beings and not people on paper. And so if I was just to look at Emmanuel on paper, I think I would look at him differently than if I never got to meet him and never got to interact with him. And I think that is what ultimately I go off of.
After years of talking to Emmanuel, after months of excavating all the details of his case, I have to say I agree. At first, I'd kept a running tally of Emmanuel's non-answers or evasions, some of which did seem troubling on paper. Why, for instance, had Emmanuel initially told police that he didn't know when he'd left the apartment complex on Monday, when he clearly did? Why did he leave the complex at all when half the Redmond PD was outside searching for witnesses? Of course, what wasn't mentioned on paper was that Emmanuel, a young black man with a lifetime of bad interactions with the cops and a warrant out for his arrest, had been terrified. And as for the claim about the time he'd left the apartment complex, that's because he was protecting Leslie Potts, who had lied for him and hidden him from police. In the interest of full disclosure, there were times when Emmanuel was not fully transparent with me or the other reporters on this series. Never, to my knowledge, about the murder or the 2004 rape charge. He's been admirably patient with us as we took him over the details of both cases, over and over again, and his story has never changed a bit. But we didn't, for example, find out that Emmanuel had been shot in June of 2008, 4 months before Arpana's murder, until we were looking through handwritten police interview notes. Emmanuel never mentioned it to us, even as we spent hours talking in detail about his life. When we did ask him about it, he said, "Yeah, that was a situation in my neighborhood." Then he clammed up. Now, someone who had decided Emmanuel is guilty might be inclined to see these omissions or half-truths as the ticks of a habitual liar, someone who can't be trusted. If Emmanuel wasn't telling it straight with the cops, wasn't telling it straight with journalists, what else might he have been hiding about that Halloween weekend in 2008? But I'd say this, context matters a lot. Emmanuel Fair spent nearly a decade of his adult life being called a murderer, and weeks on end sitting in a courtroom where prosecutors explained in explicit detail how they believed he had killed a woman. I don't know what that feels like, but I do know that if I had to go through something like that, I would cling to every scrap of self-worth I had left. Every chance to be seen in a better light, I'd take it. And the things that made me ashamed, that made me feel sad, that would make people think worse of me. I'd do my very best to avoid speaking about them, especially to the people I was closest to, or the people I decided to entrust with my life story. The second trial of Emmanuel Fair started in the late spring of 2019, more than a decade after the murder of Arpana Janaga, and nearly 9 years after Emmanuel was officially charged with the killing. In almost every way, the retrial was like the original. Same prosecutor in Aaron Ellard. Same lead defense attorney in Ben Goldsmith. Although this time, Catherine Edwards was sitting shotgun.
Our strategy was fairly consistent between trials. And I think part of that was in talking to the jurors from the first trial. It seemed like the jurors that voted guilty were just really bad jurors. So for us, our biggest focus was really on obviously dealing with the accomplice stuff, because when I was prepping for the trial, I didn't know if we were going to be doing an accomplice trial or if we were going to be doing just a trial without that instruction.
What Catherine is referring to here is complicated, but it's important. Before the jury recessed in the first trial, prosecutors had petitioned the judge to allow them to introduce what are known as accomplice instructions. They'd be able to say, in court, that they considered Cameron Johnson to be an uncharged participant in the murder of Arpana Janaga. Exactly what that participation might have looked like was always something of a mystery to Catherine.
I think their theory is that somehow Emmanuel and Cameron were, so like they were in the car listening to music, right? And then they were sort of the last two people awake potentially, although that's, I don't think, actually borne out by the facts. And that they were listening to a stupid music program that I can't remember the name of. And I think their theory is somehow that Emmanuel is like calling prostitutes, but then Cameron is calling Arpana. And then somehow Emmanuel, they definitely thought that Emmanuel was like the main person who like committed the physical violence, but that maybe Cameron was somehow involved in the cleanup with like the motor oil or something. It doesn't make any sense.
The trial judge quickly rejected the motion. But after the hung jury, the state had appealed the decision, bouncing the issue up to a 3-judge panel on a state appellate court. If they'd ruled in the prosecution's favor, the next trial would have been played under very different rules. The state would have been able to argue that Emmanuel should be declared guilty regardless of whether the jury thought beyond a reasonable doubt that he was the sole perpetrator or merely an accomplice. But the panel rejected this, just as the trial judge had. The evidence of a conspiracy, the panel wrote, was just not there. The idea that Cameron and Emmanuel, two strangers who met that night, had collaborated on either the commission of a killing or the cleanup of the murder scene, well, it didn't make sense. Was there evidence that one or the other had been involved? Yes. Was there evidence that they'd worked together? No. Which meant that by 2019, as the second trial began, Cameron Johnson would be playing a role similar to what he played in the first trial, issuing terse answers to a short list of agreed-upon questions. Catherine was doing the questioning this time, but it didn't seem to alter the outcome of the exchange.
I think it was Ben's witness in the first trial. And as I recall, he would look at his attorney, Emma Scanlon, every time to answer the question. And I imagine Emma told him, like, hey, that looks pretty suspicious. Don't do that this time. So instead, what he did was he sat at the table and he just, like, stared at his feet. And he would not look at me. And he had the oddest affect. And we had obviously gotten the judge's permission of what questions we could ask and what questions we couldn't ask. So I didn't want to, like, create a mistrial by just saying, why aren't you looking at me? But that was what I wanted to ask. And the jurors in the second trial commented that was the weirdest 3 minutes of direct testimony. It was so weird.
Once again, Cameron put on a strange performance on the stand. Once again, the defense team focused on all the other evidence pointing in all the other directions. And once again, Ben Goldsmith was tasked with the all-important closing argument. In preparation, Ben had dialed everything in, down to the clothes he was wearing as he strode to the center of the courtroom.
You know, I knew what like suit tie combination I was going to wear, because part of what I was saying in the closing was I was reminding the jurors of some of the things they had promised to do during jury selection. And so I wore the same suit tie combination as I had worn during that day of jury selection.
Ben turned, faced the jury, and did not say a word.
And, you know, the first probably 3 or 4 minutes of it was all silent because it was just me clicking through slides that had some text on it. But I didn't start speaking until probably 3.5, 4 minutes into the closing, which was a strategic choice because our theme was that the evidence speaks for itself. So I didn't want to be taking up space talking because I didn't want them to, even have to listen to me because the evidence was telling them Emmanuel's innocent. He didn't do this. Somebody else did.
Ben had no idea how the jurors were responding to this closing argument. It was all an adrenalized blur. He tried to prepare himself to wait for a verdict. But this time, the wait was pretty short.
So I was walking over to court when my cell phone rang, and I saw that it was like one of the court numbers. I picked it up. It was Judge North's bailiff, and she said, "You have to come over to court now. They have a verdict."
Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, the riveting adaptation of the best-selling true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secrets. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu. This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling t-shirts from a booth at your local farmer's market or dishing out handmade crafts online, Shopify's POS system manages it all. Unite your in-person and online business with a trusted platform that supports your retail hustle. Get started with hardware tailored to your needs, from payments on the go to full-scale retail setups, with round-the-clock support to keep your sales smooth as silk. Do the smart thing for retail. Go with Shopify. For a limited time, sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/wondery, all lowercase. Take your business to new heights. Visit shopify.com/wondery today. That's shopify.com/wondery.
As Ben Goldsmith walked to the courtroom to hear the verdict, all the emotions you'd expect to be there were there. Nervousness, fear, worry for his client. And also the same thing he'd felt when the first jury came back deadlocked. Although this time, the relief was for a very different reason.
You know, if I'm being completely honest, for me, and this is the only time I felt this way, I felt that no matter what happened, I wasn't going to have to try this case again, just because it had been, such a weight for such a long time. And that's definitely not something that I'm proud of. I mean, I think a good attorney, would say, like, let's go for round three, which there's no question I would have done had it been another mistrial. But in that moment where they said, there is a verdict, there's a part of me that felt, okay, well, this is going to be over one way or another.
Ben found Catherine in the lobby of the courthouse, and then the two lawyers went upstairs together to Emmanuel's holding cell.
We just told him, hey, there's a verdict. There was no hiding that, we were really nervous and really concerned. Not because of anything in particular, but just because, these cases are really hard to win. I mean, I think after we said, like, there's a verdict, we'll just, wasn't much to say other than, like, we're just going to have to think good thoughts and, see what happens. And if this goes poorly, obviously we'll appeal it. And he was like, all right, let's just go see what they have to say.
As they entered the courtroom, Ben was a wreck. Catherine was a wreck. But Emmanuel was calm.
I was like, I cannot look at these people when they come out. I'll listen to what they have to say, but I can't look at them. And so the jury got called in. We stood up. I put my hand on Emmanuel's shoulder and they, you know, passed their verdict up and basically just listening for whether the first consonant sound was going to be a N sound or a G sound.
Emmanuel kept his eyes trained on the jury box.
I'd seen the jurors pass the paper to the court clerk, and then the court clerk reads it. I look over at the jurors, you know what I'm saying, and I'm feeling pretty confident. And then I look over at the judge, and the judge he's looking like he's anticipating where he wants to send me. And then the clerk reads not guilty, and my attorney, she's grabbing on my arm, she's crying, and they just said, I'm going home.
Behind him, Emmanuel's aunt and uncle were on their feet, sobbing. The courtroom was alive with movement. Later that day, Emmanuel went back to his cell, this time as a free man, just to pack up his belongings and give away anything he thought other inmates might like.
What happens? Like, they just open your cell and they say,
roll your stuff up, it's time to go. And, you know, like a lot of my hygiene stuff and stuff I wasn't taking with me, I gave it away to other inmates and stuff, you know, and then went on out the front door.
And so, was it weird?
It was weird when the sun first hit me, because I felt like I haven't felt the sun in years. You know, it's different looking out a window. The sun's on this side, you know, you can't feel it. But when I walked out the door, it was like, you know, I had to close my eyes for a minute and look up at the sky. It was cool. Good feeling.
Emmanuel called his friends. One of the first was Barbara Tripp, the same woman who'd broke the news to Emmanuel 9 years earlier that he was being charged with murder.
I was at work and I got the call from him at his brother. They were like, hey, somebody wants to talk to you. It was his brother's phone number, his uncle's phone number. And I was like, hey, how's it going? And she was like, oh, hang on. Somebody wants to talk to you. And then it was him. And I was like, what?
At the time, Barbara was working at a Planned Parenthood in Washington State. When Emmanuel explained what had happened, she started to feel a little dizzy. She could see her coworkers staring at her.
My heart was pounding. I screamed. I had to leave the front desk. I went to the back and I screamed. And I was like, you're lying. You're lying. And I started crying. And the women in my clinic came and they were like, what's going on? What's going on? I was like, these are happy tears. I was like, it's fine. I was an emotional wreck. And I was like, my friend, he just got out. I was like, they let him go. And they were like, what? No way. And my boss was like, go home. And I remember I left. I got some money and went and bought him some clothes and took him a bag of stuff and gave him a hug for the first time.
In his decade in jail, Emmanuel estimates he missed about 20 funerals. This includes the funeral of one of his favorite cousins, a woman who had helped Emmanuel out during some of the hardest parts of his teen years. But his elderly aunt and uncle, Edwina and Roland, were still alive. They still lived in the family home in the Central District of Seattle. And in the weeks after his release, Emmanuel moved in with them, taking a bedroom in their house. We visited the place last summer.
This is my view.
What are we looking at? Which ones are those?
Well, that's the tallest building. I believe that's the Columbia Tower. And that's a hospital over there. And then blocked down this way, they're redoing the juvenile.
What do your aunt and uncle grow back here?
Oh, wow. He grows greens, tomatoes, green beans, corn, raspberries. I think he has onions out here too. Yeah.
Being in that garden, something about Emmanuel got lighter. He smiled more, let his shoulders drop.
We used to have a big cherry tree right here. So since I've been out, I believe my brother and my uncle tore it down, but we used to make a rope here to there, and we would play It was like a rope hooked onto the little wiffle ball. She hit the ball. That's how we learned how to play baseball.
After a while, Edwina and Roland wandered out to join us. Edwina's legs were hurting her, so she sat down, but Roland stayed standing. He leaned against the door frame with his arms crossed.
Did you guys go to the Emmanuel's trials?
The first trial, we were there every single day. Second trial, we was there every day, but one day and that we were in Florida. And we came back the day afterwards. We used to have to, I took a lunch down and we sat on the bench every day and we ate there. It was tough. It was really tough. It was a tough experience and I don't wish that on anybody.
What happened when Emmanuel was finally exonerated? How did you feel?
I shouted. You don't know what that is. Like in church, in Southern church, I couldn't help myself. I cried. I cried a lot of times. I was down there and I'd go out the room and cry, and Emmanuel would tell me, he said, "Don't cry. Don't cry." It was rough.
Roland cut in, recalling the pain he'd felt reading about Emmanuel in the news, listening to the prosecutors describe someone he did not recognize.
It was a long case. I mean, it wasn't won by no tremendous margin. This was, they used every technique they could.
Everything
they could. They even wanted to get, what do they call it, a witch doctor, sorcerers, whatever, to try to make him be the person that they wanted him to be. The way things were set up, it was just words put into place, whereas it just looked like it was nothing but a guy that was guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And they figured by him being black,
he's at the wrong place at the wrong time. Mm-hmm. But like I said, that's over with and that's behind us, and I wouldn't want to go through that again.
From start to finish, Erin Ellard of the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office dedicated 10 years of her life to obtaining a guilty verdict. When Emmanuel was acquitted, she struggled to understand it.
How do you walk away from Emmanuel's DNA being on all these different items that are so related to her death as compared to her cleanup? It's a very, you know, it's one of those cases, a lot of my cases all sit with me in different ways, right? This one sits hard.
In Erin's mind, there were a couple explanations for the outcome. Explanation one, there were a bunch of items that investigators had once believed were integral to understanding how Arpana had died. But those items either had the DNA profiles of non-suspects or they were from unidentified males. A good example is the tampon found at the crime scene, which police and prosecutors believed might have been removed by the killer. And yes, they did find male DNA on the tampon string of three people, but none were a match to Emmanuel.
You know, we felt like we were going down the dark, deep, dark hole of DNA when you get a result like that back, because it's just hard to even fathom. Like, what does that mean? Are you telling me there's three people who touched the string of the tampon? Like, even if three people were involved, I find it hard to envision three different males touching that item of evidence.
But there's another explanation, right? Which is that there was transfer of some sort.
Well, yes, and that the testing that they now do pulls up so much DNA that it could have been transferred during the manufacturing of the tampon itself. It could have been transferred during the fact that it was in a carpet and had been smushed into the carpet, that if there was a male DNA present in the carpet from somebody walking around barefoot or anything like that, could have transferred onto this tampon. It was all sorts of things that continue to make and complicate this case and trying to figure out what the truth was.
Which ties into the second reason Erin thinks the state ultimately lost. Basically, she believes there was no compelling story as to why Emmanuel might have killed Arpana. Yes, there was DNA evidence. But as Ben Goldsmith and his team repeatedly pointed out during the trials, DNA does not explain how, and most importantly, why. And the jurors needed a why.
What we learned from this case, and I think we all have to take note of it, is that people know what DNA is. And I don't think they're skeptical about it necessarily, but we're human beings, and we want to know more. And we put this DNA in front of those jurors, and we thought, you'll see this as we do. And what I think I learned from that jury afterwards is that the rest of the case had gotten so sanitized because we were so prevented from saying other things that they wanted those other things. Like, in the end, we are people, and we want to know why, and we want to know the background of others. And in some ways, it's reassuring, right? Because I don't want to become like, this is just about forensics and science. Like, our job is about people. And it's important to remember that even in the most heavy forensic case, the jurors, they're not going to feel comfortable convicting someone of a heinous crime unless they also feel like they understand more. In some ways, it's a little bit reassuring. Like, that's human nature.
So if Aaron had been able to talk about Emmanuel's priors, and particularly the third-degree rape conviction, there might have been more of a story, and that might have produced a conviction. But I'm going to push back on what Aaron is saying here a little, because I spoke to a handful of jurors who told me point blank that learning about Emmanuel's priors would not have affected their deliberations. And that includes the ones like Jeff, who were inclined to vote for a conviction. Anyway, as Aaron acknowledged towards the end of our conversation, it's basically impossible to divine the thought processes of 24 jurors over two trials. And charging anyone else for Arpana's murder in the future, in Aaron's mind, it's a long shot.
Oh, I'd talk to anybody about it if anybody wanted to, but I don't know how. You know, we've talked about it many a time. Should we have charged Cameron Johnson? I still don't think he killed her. I think he may have been involved. I think he may have lied to us. I don't think he killed Arpana. You know, he went on afterwards. He got his degree and he's never had a crime. He is kind of a normal guy that just has a job.
This argument, well, come on. It goes without saying, but an ability to get a degree and have a normal job is not necessarily evidence that one couldn't have committed violence in the past. Moreover, being, quote, a normal guy that just has a job is something that Emmanuel longed for. He lost that opportunity to be that normal guy in the decade he spent behind bars for a crime he was ultimately acquitted of. Still, I do understand one part of where Aaron's coming from. Any reopening of this case, any new indictment, would have to wrangle with the fact that Emmanuel's DNA was on the crime scene.
The DNA doesn't change. You still have Mr. Fair's DNA on her neck, on the tape, in her blood, and nobody else's DNA is there.
If a new suspect were indicted, the onus would now be on the state to explain why DNA evidence that had once been used to try to convict Emmanuel was now irrelevant.
And so even if someone came in and confessed, unless they confessed to doing it with Emmanuel Fair, it's hard to envision how it would ever be a case that you could prove because the DNA evidence doesn't change.
Not so long ago, I met up with Brian Coates, the lead investigator on the Janaga case, at the Redmond Police Department's headquarters. Coates is in his late 50s and edging towards retirement after a long career. He made it clear to me that this had been the case, the one that got away.
Well, you just said it, the one that got away from me. So I would think, if I think back on this case, it's, what did I do to fail? Since we weren't able to bring the case to a conclusion to hold somebody accountable for the crime.
Only a handful of people knew exactly what had happened at the Valley View in October of 2008. And one of them was dead.
She can't say what happened. So we have to take the physical evidence, the witnesses, and all that facts to put it all together to paint the story to say this is what happened, why it happened, and who did it.
Which is what Coates and his colleagues had tried to do. They tried their best. So I asked Coates the same thing I'd asked Aaron Ellard. If that's the case, what happened? Why did the first trial end like it did? And why did the second?
I believe in juries. I mean, people have a right to be judged by their peers, and I'm a deep believer in the Constitution. But it is not perfect because you are, decisions are based on emotion more than just looking at facts.
But Coates does seem to understand the uncertainty that a lot of the jurors felt, because he feels it too.
I would love to go back in time and see a video reenactment just to see what really happened, because I don't think we'll ever know. But the questions will haunt me forever.
I said my goodbyes to Coates and headed back to my Airbnb to get some rest. Because the next day, our reporting team, me, Eric, and Natalia, had a long drive ahead of us. And someone very important to meet.
Hey, how you doing? Hey, we're looking for Cameron.
Yeah, let me go get him.
Okay, sure.
That's next time on the 9th and final episode of Suspect.
Cam, someone's here for you.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Suspect ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
From Campside and Wondery, this is episode 8 of 9 of Suspect. Suspect was reported by Eric Benson, Natalia Winkleman, and me, Matthew Scher. Eric and I are producers. David Waters is the executive producer. Our editor is Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Field production by Kyle Norris. Aaliyah Papes and Callie Hitchcock are assistant producers. Fact-checking by Matthew Giles. Original music by Doug Slaywin and Netta Hadari. Consulting producers are Laura Ricciardi and Josie Duffy Rice. Our engineer is Jackie Sajiko. Mixing by Jackie Sajiko, Mark McAdam, and Garrett Tiedemann. Additional production assistance from Rod Sherwood. Studio engineer is Judd Caswell at Frog Hollow Studio in Topsom, Maine. At Campside, the executive producers are me, Vanessa Gregoriadis, Josh Dean, and Adam Hoff. For Wondery, Chris Siegel is the producer. Production assistance from Fiona Pastana. Managing producer is Lata Pandya. Executive producers are George Lavender, Marshall Louie, and Jen Sargent. I'm about to play you a preview of the true crime series Over My Dead Body's new season, Fox Lake. While you're listening, be sure to follow Over My Dead Body on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or you can listen early and ad-free by subscribing to Wondery Plus and the Wondery app.
We got an officer down. Officer down at the swamp.
A massive manhunt in northern Illinois for 3 suspects in the killing of a veteran police officer, Charles Joseph Glinowitz.
I couldn't believe it. Who in the hell could beat that man? Like, who in the hell got the upper hand on him?
He's Joe Glinowitz. He's Joe f***ing Glinowitz. You know what I mean?
From Wondery, the makers of Joe Exotic and The Shrink Next Door, comes a story about how the hunt for a killer revealed secrets hidden just below the surface.
I was told in a very strong voice, it's none of your business. You don't need to know that, doctor.
Secrets that everyone in Fox Lake would rather forget.
Fox Lake had that reputation, a little bit on the dark side.
We saw that the packet of the powder, which later turned out to be, cocaine.
It wouldn't shock me if you tried to plant something on her, but to kill her, no.
I got the hell out of that town because small towns are just no good for anybody.
Follow Over My Dead Body Season 3 Fox Lake on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can listen early and ad-free by subscribing to Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
I don't think we ever knew what was behind that closed door with G.I. Joe Glenowitz.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.